Welcome to Hometown to Hollywood. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide. And today my guest is singer-songwriter Aaron Benward.
Hey.
Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So you and I first met late at night in the snow on the set of Cloud Nine, and we were watching our kids film an on-screen kiss.
Oh my gosh.
And at the time, I just knew that you were a great dad, I could tell that you were a great dad. For various, you know, spending weeks on the snow with your son at that point. But I had no idea that you were a professional singer-songwriter as well. But of course, kids often get creative gifts from their parents. And in fact, your own father was a professional singer-songwriter. So when did you know that you wanted to do this for a living?
Oh, gosh. It's funny because my dad, like you said, growing up, he was a gospel singer. So he put food on the table by going out to churches and even the Billy Graham Crusade, he sang in front of Billy Graham. And so I watched him sing and emote and bring people to a place of experience emotionally through music. And growing up, my mom, she said, Aaron, you need to learn how to play the piano. So at 9 years old, I started playing the piano, and I hated it. every day, man. She was like, all right, 30 minutes before you go outside. 30 minutes. I remember times crying, Mom, I don't want to do this. But she was instilling me discipline. You know, at the time, you know, as a young 8, 9, 10-year-old, I was like, I hated it. But at the same time, I think there's some times as parents, I'm grateful my mom did it, showed me that, you know, if she saw something without me seeing it. And I think as parents, sometimes we should do that for our children. She saw a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, so I continued to study piano and to a point where then sports took over. I was a big athlete, and that's kind of really what I wanted to spend all my time doing. All the while singing and dancing and acting and musicals and that kind of thing. So I kind of had the best of both worlds. And it really wasn't until, to your question, the day I graduated from high school, and I was in Franklin, Tennessee, which is just outside Nashville, where I grew up. And my dad said, okay, bud, what are you going to do with your life? Today is the day you graduate. And I said, Dad, you know what? I don't know. I think I'm supposed to do what you do. And he looked at me with big eyes, and he was like, man, are you sure? Are you sure you want to do this? And I said, Dad, yeah, I absolutely do. Music is my love and passion. And so he, right there on the spot, he said, well, I was on my way to college for the first year, and which I did. And he said, while you're at school, because it was in Nashville where I went, Belmont University, if you want to come out and sing with me and travel with me and kind of feel the road and get all that and kind of understand that, then come on. So I was able to apprentice under my dad for the first couple of years, which then led us to a major record deal together. And so I think we're one of very few father and sons in the history of music that went on to record 3 albums together on a major record label and toured all over the world for 10 years.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you apprenticed with and then basically partnered with your dad.
I did, and that's an interesting thing you bring up, the partner aspect, because it's the apprenticeship was awesome because it was a father and a son, him really helping me grow up and understand the art and the craft. And then as I became my own man, it can get a little tough, to be honest. He's my best friend even to today, and we work through so many great things and tough things at times. Going from a dad and a son to equal business partners was a challenge. And also, throw into that mix art.
Yes.
Because as a young man, as somebody who was very, wanted to experience and experiment with art and music, my dad, with his knowing what he knew for all, well, 20 plus years before I joined him, had obviously his way of going about it, and I had a new way. And so it came to a head sometimes, and which then eventually, you know, I went on out on my own, did a solo album.
But while you were with your dad, you guys were extremely successful. You did make 3 albums, and you had 10 number one Billboard Christian country music singles, and you sold over 1 million copies on your release.
Yeah.
Like, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was
that's
wild.
Not nothing. That's not like a casual sort of coffee house circuit thing.
No, it wasn't. It was a scenario where, you know, we had the whole bus and tour bus and the whole deal. We went by Aaron Jeffrey. That was the name of our duo. My name's Aaron. My dad's name's Jeffrey. And we toured with, you know, some of the biggest acts in contemporary Christian music. And gosh, we sang for stadiums of people at times for doing different events. And, you know, I think what it was, Bonnie, was that it was very unique and special to see a father and son working together, first of all. And we truly, truly admire and love each other. And so people felt that. And really, that's what our message was, to mm-hmm. that, you know what, you can, it's okay to hang with your dad, man.
Love and family.
100%.
I love that. 100%. Well, you know, we're all very close with our kids, yes, and that's one of the many things we have in common and that I so love and appreciate about you and your family.
Thank you.
And then there came a point where you decided to strike out on your own as a solo artist.
I did. And it was, that was the tension, I think, a lot of it. My dad finally had found some commercial success. Mm-hmm. We were selling albums and we were having, like you mentioned, the success on the radio charts. And my mom and he had finally got their big house on the hill. And, you know, at the same time, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I needed mm-hmm. to spread my wings. And I had already had a family at the time, too. My wife and I had two children. And so I did. And I did a record on EMI. And what I thought would be the next best thing to sliced bread came out. And, you know, it was my first single did pretty well. It's the number one song. And then after that, it was just like it didn't exist. And, you know, the sales weren't there. And I did one tour, and I got to the end of that kind of season, about 12 months, about a year, and I realized I was in the wrong genre. I realized that for me, the art did not meet, and the commerce of that did not meet up. Although I'm a man of faith inside, that didn't necessarily mean that my art needed to always exemplify that.
Of course not. I mean, there are many people in the creative world that have deeply held convictions, but that doesn't mean that that's the flavor of art that they need to produce consistently, right?
Absolutely. I mean, mm-hmm. I think you look at the only genre of music that is labeled by its lyrical content is Christian music. You know, it's always about, you know, certain aspects of faith in God and Jesus specifically. And I think that's great. But I also had a very, very big problem with charging people tickets to come and, quote, worship. It was hard for me to justify. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's not great, and I think there's a lot of people that do it and do it well. And, you know, Christian music came about out of the hippie movement as an alternative to what was going on in secular music. And, hey, we can do it just as good as they are, but we have an alternative for you, which I think is great for a lot of people in this country and around the world. But for me, I wanted to be able to have a fresh palette, a clean palette, and a canvas that I could write and sing whatever I wanted. And so, therefore, that's when, after that solo record in Christian music, I then began to go on a journey to decide and figure out where I was and who I was.
Well, and you have a really unique sound. I have to confess, I'm not a country music girl. I'm from the Northwest, you know, which sure. is not like the land of country music. It's the land of something else. I don't know what.
The land of Nirvana. Grunge. Come on.
It's Pearl Jam and Nirvana, mm-hmm. let's be honest. And yet I've attended, I don't know how many different shows of yours, and I love them. I love the music that you make. And I think it's actually very, very universal.
Well, thanks. I that's a big, big compliment to me, because, you know, I think I've taken everything I think thus far that I've been influenced by, and that's obviously gospel and Christian music. Some of the greatest songwriters that my dad would throw on them every day. I'll never forget. I come home from school. I come home from practice, and he loved to cook. My mom not necessarily so much. Sorry, mom. Sorry, but my dad was the creative cook guy. But he would always have on Jimmy Webb or James Taylor or some of the great, great songwriters, Glen Campbell. And I remember just that was always going through my mind and my head as we would come together and have dinner as a family. And those things were big influences on me, as well as some of the other great, you know, vocalists like Kenny Loggins mm-hmm. and Bryan Adams. And so hopefully all of that kind of comes together. Honestly, country music per se, back in the, you know, 70s, 80s, where I was growing up as a child, that wasn't really a big part of my listening palette, to be honest with you. I liked the greats, the guys that were the biggest, the Johnny Cashes and that kind of thing. But to really dive in and be that guy that knows all the history of country music, that wasn't me until I got into it.
Well, so that's why your sound is a little bit more of a hybrid, maybe.
Yeah, definitely.
So walk me through what the songwriting process looked like when you were just starting to write professionally. What did that look like?
It was scary. I was a 19-year-old boy coming into manhood, real manhood, trying to figure out, knowing that I wanted to be a writer. I wasn't the kind of kid that sat around in my room alone with a guitar and just play till my fingers bled, nor did I get out a tablet and just write till I couldn't write anymore. I was very much an athlete and very much a more of a performer than I was an actual writer artist, but I wanted to be one, and I think that was part of the reason why I became one. And I believe there are two types of writers. I believe there are those that just literally just falls out of them because it's in the very DNA of who they are and the cells in who they are. Then I think there are those who have the gift and discover it and work like somebody else who works. And I began to get around people that were great as a young guy. And at times in those rooms, you're sitting there and you're writing a song and everybody's looking at each other and you're collaborating and you really think to yourself, do I really have anything to say? You get insecure. You get, man, if I put that out in the room, what kind of energy or what kind of response is going to come back? And so I just kept doing it, man, in spite of the fear that I had. And the first song that I ever wrote was the first song that my dad and I ever released. That was the first number one song we had.
Get out.
Yeah.
Well, that must have helped your confidence just a little.
A little bit. It did.
Well, so what's it like to collaborate with a singer or another songwriter? How do you find collaborators? How do they find you?
Collaboration is what Nashville is really built on. There are those who write by themselves, but there's a beauty of worlds colliding. And collaboration, some days you might carry it. Some other days the other writer or two that are in the room or three might carry it. But I've always been one to believe, because I was taught this, that there are no bad ideas, maybe just wrong timing.
My dad
used to tell me that.
I love that. Everybody just like file that away.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah, because you can throw something out that literally has nothing to do with the song or has nothing to do with the screenplay or has nothing to do with whatever you're creating and you're collaborating with someone, but yet it takes you to the place that you end up. You know,
yes.
Because of the discussion or because the off the wallness or because of the humor, because you're throwing out a line in a song that you know is not going to make it, but it's hilarious and it breaks the tension or breaks the you know, the monotony or whatever that needs to be broken in the moment. So in collaborating, we always try to be a yes and person. And that, again, there's no bad idea. It's just not necessarily the right timing, maybe.
Now, you're married to an actress. Is that like a little improv trick she taught you?
She did. Of course. Oh, yeah. She did. She was really good. Kendall was really good about it. My wife was really good about it. When I would sing a vocal. I never thought of it this way, but I would sing a vocal on a record or whatever, and she's like, now, what were you thinking? What's going through your head when you sing the song? I'm thinking, babe, I'm just singing a song. I'm trying to emote. She's like, well, maybe you should like get into, put yourself in some type of scenario and environment. Like, well, she kind of brought a different aspect to that, which is good.
Trying to help you with motivation.
She did, absolutely.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Your family. So great. Well, so you've written a number of songs that have ended up on TV shows, you know,
yes.
And that's really interesting. And I know that there's a lot of mystique around that. What does your writing process look like when you're writing for TV? Is it any different than when you're just writing for yourself? Or?
Yeah, it is. I actually love writing. I call it target writing, meaning you have, let's take TV for instance, a TV show, and they have said, hey, we're looking for a song that has this line, this word specifically, or this idea, or this, you know, we want it to say, have this in the song, or we want to feel this way, or... Anyway, they give you this target to shoot at. And, you know, as a songwriter, there's an element of inspirational writing, meaning being inspired to write something. And then there's the aspect of making a living.
Oh, there's that chop wood, carry water thing.
100%.
Right?
Absolutely. And there's a commercial. The commercialism aspect is very, very real if you're going to make a living at it. And not just go play coffee houses, which is great, but I want to make it to where I can, you know, put my kids to college. So,
yeah,
you know what I mean? So I love target writing. I feel really, really like I'm not compromising in any way in my mind. I'm doing it unto something. And, you know, like, for instance, the song in Nashville that I had called Who I Am, that was different. That was writing with a young aspiring artist in Nashville. I had just moved there, and he had, you know, there was no mountain he couldn't climb, too high he couldn't climb. And we started being real, man, and started talking about what it takes to make it, what it takes to kind of figure it all out. And I was jaded, to be honest with you. I was sitting there going, okay, this is a new kid, and, we're going to write some happy song, and it's going to be like Life is Beautiful, and, you know, bluebirds are singing every day. And as we got real, I said, let's write this. And so we did, and it became one of the songs on Nashville that I think is the only one that's been played twice. And so that was different. So that wasn't a target. That was actually being honest and real and inspiring. So I think there's both ways you can kind of get it.
I just was overwhelmed with the sad realization that I could have asked you to bring your guitar today.
Oh, yes.
Because I tell you what, I've heard you play and sing that song.
Oh, thanks.
And it is the most beautiful song, and it gives me chills every time I hear it.
Oh.
And I just love that song.
Oh, thank
and it's
you.
A very, I think, part thank of why it's so moving. Well, it's moving, is the first thing. It's like, I love to be moved. To me, that's one of the great, you know, hallmarks of true art is it moves me. It makes me feel something. And that song makes me feel something because it's so raw and it's so honest.
Thank you.
And it's not just a happy song. It's like, it's grappling, you know, with real doubt and hope.
Mm.
And, I mean, gosh, what more could you hope for when you write a song or create a piece of art?
Yeah. Man? Yeah. It's true. It's definitely true. It was one of those days. And thank you for saying that. I can send you the record. You can play
really?
A piece of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Could I?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I'll splice something in, because you guys should hear the song, because it's exquisite.
Yeah.
And then you should probably find a way to buy it. Because I'm not kidding. It's just, and then it'll introduce you to Aaron's work.
I've always been broken underneath my smile. So you think that I was happy all the while. If I'm being honest, I didn't stand a chance. Is that who I am? Staring at my shadow for way too long. If I never did nothing, nothing could go wrong. I've always been singing, never had a song. Is that who I am? I see big brown burning in the atmosphere, calling my name, calling my name, saying
okay, great. This isn't just a song that I'm going to write and then it's going to sit in somebody, some publisher's drawer somewhere and never be heard again. So, but constraint writing, like you said, is not easy. There's rhyming involved, there's music involved, there's all these things that are involved to make it happen.
So, the landscape of the music business has changed a lot since you first started writing, and it's changing pretty much as we speak. The streaming technology, how music is distributed, it's changed the game completely. But at the same time, the one thing that hasn't changed is music copyright law, and that hasn't been updated for almost 100 years, which is just astonishing, since 1909. So you are working on with some professional songwriter friends under the name of Ghost Town Troubadours. Ghost Town Troubadours, such a cool name, to make a documentary to bring attention to this issue. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, you opened up a Pandora's box here for
me. I know.
So, this is probably the most passionate thing I have going on in my life right now. Myself and three other career songwriters, who also are really, really close friends of mine, Danny Myrick, Travis Howard, and Reggie Hamm, and I, were talking about just the state of affairs, meaning how we're going to survive as career songwriters. This was over the last year and a half or so. And you mentioned the landscape's changing. I mean, it's changing and continuing to change at a rapid pace. I mean, music is being consumed at a higher pace than ever before, which is great. The consumer is doing what they're supposed to do, and if they can get it for free, they're going to take it. But what people don't understand, the thing we're trying to do with this documentary is the only way we're going to see change, because we have numerous songwriters, including ourselves, have gone and are going to Capitol Hill. We have significant voices being louder than ever with the DOJ, who are in charge of all of these copyright scenarios, that are just basically looking at it and continuing to slough it off. And we are trying to change public opinion, because I think the public has no idea, one, there is even this small kind of microcosm of people called songwriters that do it for a living, but also the fact that if they do know about the songwriters, they feel probably like they are paid like the artists that they see, or they're hanging out with famous people all the time, or they're famous themselves, or whatever else. And really, it's just a bunch of blue-collar people that pick up their lunch pail every day and pick up their pen every day and their guitar and or their whatever their instrument is, and try to write something in a way you never heard before that hopefully becomes a soundtrack to your life. And they're not being compensated like they should. And what we're finding out is that it's big business against the little guys. You know, yes, it's back the consent decree was looked at in 1940 as well, 1941 actually. And we now, in 2016, are still basically being paid under something that was not even in existence. Streaming, file sharing, digital, nothing was even there. It was a phonograph record. And so that's the smallest part of it. The biggest part of it is that now streaming, which is how we're listening to our music. My daughters, man, I don't think they've ever turned on a radio station, terrestrial radio. They're listening to their streaming, their Pandora, they're listening to Spotify, their playlists they personally put together that are just a wide array of genres of music, which is incredible. Their musical palette is amazing, but at the same time, this generation is just listening for free. And, you know, there are people, there are families, there are men and women behind those songs. Some are the artists that are writing it with them, but vast majority aren't. 90% of the working songwriter in Nashville, Tennessee, are gone, and they're not. There's no way to make a living. You go back to the era where we're selling albums at a high rate, '90s. You know, just to kind of boil it down so people can understand. If I would have had a song on Garth Brooks' record that sold 30 plus million copies, and paid the statutory rate, which is what we're talking about here, every song on those records were paid 9 cents. Per song was being paid out to the songwriters and publishers. So at a million records, that's $90,000.
That's pretty great.
On a song. So mm-hmm. If I wrote it by myself and I own my publishing on 1 million albums, I'd have made 90 grand. Not bad.
No. And if you co-wrote it, maybe 45K.
Exactly.
Okay.
And if I had a publishing deal with like Sony, for instance, then split 45K in half. So 20, okay. 27. But times 30 million, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Now, the highest selling records are Adele records, which... is interesting. I mean, it's a whole nother story. But, you know, she's selling records around the world at about 6 to 7 million a clip. Taylor Swift, 3 million. Okay? The major, major artists that are you're hearing on the radio are selling, they're lucky to sell half a million copies.
And why this is so, they're not selling because nobody's buying them, say, mm-hmm. on iTunes. They're just streaming them for free.
That's right.
So they may be listening to them all day long everywhere, mm-hmm. but there's no actual sale going on.
That's right.
Got it.
And when you stream that song, let's take the Justin Timberlake tune this summer. That was the biggest song of the summer, right? Which I loved. Basically, every time that song is streamed, 0.0005, 5/10,000ths of a penny is being paid.
Oh my goodness!
To the intellectual property owners.
So basically, nobody could make a living. Almost with hits.
You mentioned earlier before the podcast, you're talking about this Diane Warren and how, and mm-hmm. she, you know, she's one of the biggest songwriters in the history of songwriting, who has a building in Hollywood and everything else. If Diane Warren showed up today and had the hits she had back then today with no radio and only streaming, she couldn't pay for it. She couldn't pay a mortgage. There's no way. And so as terrestrial radio is going out, you can look at the numbers.
Totally.
It's going away.
Yeah.
And streaming is growing. What we found, which is really disgusting for me to say, is that in around 2000, when these streaming companies came out, they're the three major record companies, Sony, Universal, and Warner Brothers, sat with these streaming companies and struck their deals with them. because record companies are in the business of, you know, selling, if you will, the masters. The master meaning the recording.
Whoever owns the master is who makes the money, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
And they sat at that table with those streaming companies, said, don't worry about the intellectual property people, namely the songwriters and publishers. We'll take care of them. They're our friends. They blah, blah. And now to this day, it's documented. Go look it up. Over 50% of all the revenue in streaming companies go to these three major record companies, pretty much. And we've been shot by friendly fire, basically. And so what we're trying to do is, me and my buddies and Ghost Town Troubadours, is that we're bringing public public awareness to go, hey, we got out on the road. Part of the documentary, we went on tour and we gigged our way across the country from Nashville to LA. And every show paid for the next one, which is interesting. But we got out there and we started asking people about music and how they consume it and what it means. On a scale of 1 to 10, what does music mean to you? And pretty much everybody said, oh, it means 15 to me, which is over. I'm like, absolutely. If a song is a pie and that pie is a dollar, what do you think a songwriter gets? And 95% or more of 100 or 200 people we asked would have said, well, I think the songwriter should probably get at least half.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
They thought that.
Because without the songwriter, you wouldn't have a song.
Well, which is true, but it happens to not work out that way.
No, 9 cents or less. So, anyway, so sorry to get on that little soapbox, but
no,
it's something that people need to know.
It's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast, because this is critical. It's sort of like, in my mind, it's like our problem with the bees. It's like, without the bees, we pretty much can't eat or survive, because the bees pollinate, you know, everything that we need to live, and the bees are going down. It's like, well, what's going to happen if the bees are gone?
Yeah.
You know, this is a crisis. And what's going to happen if the songwriters go down? Well, you know, we won't die, but part of our hearts will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of what makes being alive so sweet,
right,
will disappear if songs are all written by computers, or like, who's going to write them if you cannot make a living writing songs anymore? So this is critical.
It is.
But it's an almost invisible problem that I think if we can just shine a light on it, and people can understand it, maybe we can move the needle on it.
Yeah, and I would encourage those listening to just do some research and look up songwriters, the Copyright Act, DOJ, some of the things that they've been handing down recently that are ridiculous. And if you have some, if you enjoy getting involved and having a voice to help make change for things that matter, then, you know, write a letter to your congressman.
So that was my next question. What can listeners do to help artists at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Writing letters to their congressmen.
Yep. I mean, if you love the song, buy it.
If you love the song, buy it. It's like 99 cents or $1.29.
Right. Exactly.
It's not going to kill you.
Yeah.
Buy the song.
Yeah.
Help the songwriter.
Yeah.
Now, you've also, just to change the subject a tiny bit, mm-hmm. Created a show called Nashville Unplugged.
Yes.
And that's run since, I think, 2009 in Las Vegas every mm-hmm. week. And I've had a chance to see several of those mm-hmm. concerts that you've brought to Los Angeles here. And I really, really love them. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do in Nashville Unplugged? Because it's a really unique concept.
Sure. Those that have ever visited Nashville, Tennessee, and have gone or heard of the Bluebird Cafe, they understand kind of the songwriter show. That's kind of the sanctuary, if you will, for that. And there's other numerous venues across that city in Nashville that you have songwriters like myself that sit on stools and enjoy just being able to share their music and the stories behind the song. And so when I got off the road touring, I'm just kind of looking for the next thing that I wanted to do. I brought this concept to Vegas, and currently we are every single Friday night at Mandalay Bay Hotel on the Strip at 8 p.m. Nashville Unplugged is the name of the show, and every Friday I bring different hit songwriters out there with me. And so picture this. We're sitting on the stage on stools with acoustic guitars, and kind of like we're on your back porch or in your living room. Just sharing our life, really.
It's intimate. It's a bit like the podcast.
Yeah,
music.
It really kind of is, isn't it? Yeah. And as you know, oftentimes I've learned over the last 7 years, man, I've had over probably 150 or more great songwriters as my guests and friends, and you know, these are my peeps, man. This is my community. But I sit there and I'm just constantly amazed by the talent of just the way they craft songs. Oftentimes way better. You'll hear a song that you, oh, that guy wrote that song, and you've heard it on the radio by the artist, and that guy who wrote the song slays it, like kills it.
I have had that experience at your Nashville Unplugged concerts a few times. Like, you know, like I said, I'm not like, I don't know a whole lot of music in that genre, but I'll be like, I know that song. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. But to hear the person who wrote it, singing it and playing it, it just lands in your heart in a very special way.
Most of those songwriters came to Nashville to be artists. You know, they had the talent. They had, obviously.
Clearly they have, you know, the talent. Mean? Yeah.
And, you know, gosh, you know this, there's no rhyme or reason in any of this crazy business called entertainment of how people are successful. But so they sing and play their butt off and write great. And so anyway, it's been so fun to see it grow and to see people enjoy it and finally make it to the Las Vegas Strip. And really, it's the only show in Las Vegas that's completely they're people's own songs. I mean, there's no, it's not a cover show. Most of the music in Vegas is all about cover bands or shows on the Strip that are music. You know, these are all the real writers and all their own music.
So, and you guys are basically there every Friday night.
We are there every Friday night.
At Mandalay Bay.
At Mandalay Bay, 8 p.m.
So for anybody who goes to Vegas or is going to Vegas, I know a lot of people go there kind of regularly.
Yeah.
8 o'clock Mandalay Bay Friday nights. I can't recommend the show highly enough. I really can't. I love it. It's very, very special. And if you get a chance to see it, do, because you'll be glad you did.
And you can go to the Facebook page. It's Nashville Unplugged. It's just a fan page. Go like it and it has all the information on
there. Oh, there you go. So then you know what the sketch is.
Right.
So now, if you were talking to a young songwriter today, Aaron, with everything you know, what advice would you give them?
Man, honestly, it's changed. What I used to say to them was, be honest and write honestly from your heart. Find great people to collaborate with. Do it every day, like you're going to work. Now, because of the state of being a professional songwriter and how to stay alive, I would say write from your heart and own your music.
Own the masters.
Own the masters.
Invest in the masters.
And because just showing up to a publishing company, what used to be where you could come in and, you know, they would give you basically a draw, we call it. It's basically a salary that's recoupable on your future royalty earnings, which is still there in a very, very small way. And being able to do that and then pay back what they've paid you and then actually be able to get ahead financially is, I don't think, is there anymore at all.
From what I've seen, it looks next to impossible, especially when the artist is not in charge of the accounting.
Yep.
And all kinds of stuff gets thrown onto that before they can get any further money. Well, this is neat because this lets me circle back to another question that I would have if I were a young aspiring songwriter. Mm-hmm. How in the world would you find like an agent or someone to represent you or a publisher? How does that happen?
It's hard. It's hard. Like an actor, it's hard to get an agent. You know, it's hard to kind of get in those rooms. Without having something under your belt. I think as a young aspiring singer-songwriter, I would start by playing wherever you are. If you live in Akron, Ohio, or you live in Los Angeles, or you live in Omaha, and you're an aspiring singer-songwriter, and that's what you love and are passionate about, and that's who you believe to be, do it. And do it locally. And begin to build a following to where people know and understand who you are as an artist. At the same time, be very, very prevalent and current on your social media.
Mm-hmm.
I new aspiring singer-songwriters, I was just talking to one last week, I tell them to find a current song that's a hit, do your rendition of it on YouTube, and do that every single week, and then begin to implement and integrate your own music.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where then you can eventually hopefully get to just playing your own music, because people are going to find you through those types of ways of things that are out there that are current. But to find a publisher, God, I don't know if you need it anymore. I hate to say that. Because if you, that's just kind of what you want to do, and that's kind of a thing in your life that you want to, that will cause you to check it off, check the box off, then you got to go to Nashville or you got to go to LA. And you got to have great songs, and you have to be willing to look at your music and go and look at who it might be competitive with. You know, Are you competitive with Keith Urban? Are you competitive with Halsey? Are you who what's your world? Mm-hmm. And just because your grandmother likes it doesn't mean it's great. You know, just because your mom and dad say it's the best thing they've ever doesn't mean it's great.
Yeah, you need a bigger sample set.
You really
that.
Do. Yeah. You know? And I don't mean say it to be mean. I say it to be honest with them. Yeah. With the kids that I talk to. But I would go back to, man, make your own music. Become great at your instrument. Learn technology. Because technology is such a big part of recording now. Pro Tools or Logic or whatever that may be. And then, you know, get out there and play and put it up on social media and grow it and be, I was at YouTube. This is maybe a little bit interesting for people listening. I was at YouTube headquarters here in LA just a few weeks back, talking to them about some things that I'm working on with them. And I was asking them, is there a formula for the what they call their, influencers? Is there a formula for the ones that have this massive following of millions and millions of people? And they said, the girl that I was talking to, she said, man, no, other than consistency. I said, what we've seen in our research is that the people that have been consistent with content, no matter what that content is, it obviously doesn't matter. But that when people come back to that channel, there's something new.
Every single, whatever that is, every single right. day, every right. single week, every exactly. single month, mm-hmm. whatever you do, stick to it.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's really good advice. And I also really the silver lining mm-hmm. of the big cloud for mm-hmm. songwriters at the moment mm-hmm. is the fact that it is in fact possible to do what you want to do without those gatekeepers. You yes. really can self-produce. You really can get your stuff out there and create a platform all on your own.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that because I'm definitely not sky's falling guy at all because I love art and I love how the horizon is just so... It's wide open and the expanse is so big with the potential of music right now, but just do it, just own it, and that's a great place to be. Now that doesn't mean that tomorrow what used to be you could walk into a record company, get signed, and within a few months you could be out on the radio and become a star, which used to happen more frequently than now. But what can happen is that you can do it your way, you can be in control of your art. You can spend as much time on it as you want in your own bedroom, if you have the studio or whatever house you record music. And then you can create a great YouTube channel or a great Instagram or whatever your means of getting out there. And your brand is your brand, and you have the ability to monetize that now.
Well, and frankly, from an artist standpoint, you've got much greater possibility of true creative control.
Yes,
which is something that I appreciate.
Absolutely.
You know? And I know a lot of other artists do too, because the minute you get, beholden to, a label or mm-hmm. what have you, then it becomes a matter of trying to find the sweet spot between what they want and what you want. And
that's absolutely true.
That can involve a lot of compromise artistically.
More compromise, because the record companies and publishing companies a lot of times are run by people who, for whatever, tried to be the creative and couldn't. Tried to be the creative and maybe didn't have what it took. And so therefore they got to a place and became an executive. And so they still feel like they want to put their mark and their stamp on something creatively, but yet they don't know how to do it.
Yeah, and if you're lucky, you get somebody that you can really co-create and collaborate with in that position. And if you're unlucky, it might be just really, really challenging.
Really frustrating.
And you just don't know, and that's going to be pretty random.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an interesting world to be a songwriter in right now.
It is.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
Man, I think that the voice of culture comes out of art, and I'm a big proponent of that. I think that we have the ability as artists, no matter if you're a parent listening and you have a young aspiring actor or singer-songwriter or painter or dancer or pottery maker, it doesn't matter. The expression of art is the most beautiful, holy, sacred thing, and I would just encourage those who are that and or have that in their home to continue to elevate it, encourage it. Don't say, son, you got to have a backup plan, because if they do, they're going to fall back on it. Continue to encourage them to be who they are inside and who God's created them to be, and this universe needs their energy and it needs their art and it needs their expression, and it's going to continue to be more beautiful and beautiful if we allow it to happen.
I love that. That's a beautiful way to end.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Aaron. Thank you. Oh, real quick, before we let the people go, I want to say how people can find you. So on Twitter, you're just Aaron Benward, mm-hmm. and that's A-A-R-O-N.
That's right.
B-E-N-W-A-R-D, Aaron with two A's. Instagram, same thing, right?
Same thing.
Mm-hmm. And then on Facebook, you've got a Nashville Unplugged page.
I do. Yep.
And then Ghost Town Troubadours can be found on Instagram and Facebook as Ghost Town Troubadours. But then on Twitter, it's Ghost Town Troubs.
No adores, just Troubs. Already taken. So yeah, if you guys would do that, we're in the beginning phases of this documentary, and we thank you for helping us get this thing going. We're just trying to help the next generation, honestly, of songwriters.
That's what all of this is all about. This is about education and inspiration.
Absolutely.
Passing it on.
It's great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you like what you heard here, subscribe to this free podcast and leave a quick rating and review. A moment to click on a star rating really helps, and a minute to write a sentence-long review makes a real difference in the ranking for this podcast. Thank you so much for helping me. Do you want to know more about getting a young actor up and running in Hollywood? Buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. And if you need specific help getting your career or your child's career up and running or to the next level, you can get a one-on-one consultation with me over Skype or in person in Los Angeles. Go to my website, hollywoodparentsguide.com, and click on the consultations page. Thanks, and see you next week.